Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've just had the most incredible week at the Miami International Book Fair. I spoke with many of the brightest stars in our literary landscape. Jeffrey Eugenides, Michael Ondaatje, John Sayles, Taya Obrecht, Karen Russell, just to name a few. It was absolutely thrilling to have one-on-one conversations with authors who are topping all the bestseller lists. The authors were very generous with their time and were warm, wonderful people. Over the next few weeks, you'll be hearing these conversations and listening to previews of new works. This week, we'll speak with two journalistic legends, Pete Hamill and Edna Buchanan. Both were at the fair introducing their new works. So, without further delay, let's turn to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Isabel Wilkerson chronicles one of the great untold stories of American history in The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Wilkerson follows the decades-long migration of black citizens who left the South for northern and western cities in search of a better life. From 1915 to 1970, this exodus of almost 6 million people changed the face of America. Wilkerson interviewed more than 1,000 people and gained access to previously untapped data and official records. The result is the definitive account of how these American journeys unfolded, altering our cities, our country, and ourselves. Robin Miles narrates.
Our mattresses were made of corn shucks and soft gray Spanish moss that hung from the trees. From the swamps, we got soup turtles and baby alligators. And from the woods we got raccoon, rabbit, and possum. Mahalia Jackson, moving on up. Leaving. This land is first and foremost his handiwork. It was he who brought order out of primeval wilderness. Wherever one looks in this land, whatever one sees that is the work of man, was erected by the toiling, straining bodies of blacks. David L. Cohn, God Shakes Creation. They fly from the land that bore them. W. H. Stillwell. 1. Chickasaw County, Mississippi, late October, 1937. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. The night clouds were closing in on the salt licks east of the Oxbow Lakes along the folds in the earth beyond the Yallabusha River. The cotton was at last cleared from the field. Ida Mae tried now to get the children ready and to gather the clothes and quilts and somehow keep her mind off the churning within her. She had sold off the turkeys and doled out in secret the old stools, the wash pots, the tin tub, the bed pallets. Her husband was settling with Mr. Ed over the worth of a year's labor, and she did not know what would come of it. None of them had been on a train before, not unless you counted the clattering local from Bacon Switch to Okolona, where by the time you sit down, you're there, as Ida Mae put it. None of them had been out of Mississippi, or Chickasaw County for that matter. There was no explaining to little James and Velma the stuffed bags and chaos and all that was at stake, or why they had to put on their shoes and not cry, and bring undue attention from anyone who might happen to see them leaving. Things had to look normal, like any other time they might ride into town, which was rare enough to begin with. Velma was 6. She sat with her ankles crossed and 3 braids in her hair and did what she was told. James was too little to understand. He was 3. He was upset at the commotion. "Hold still now, James. Let me put your shoes on," Ida May told him. James wriggled and kicked. He did not like shoes. He ran free in the field. What were these things? He did not like them on his feet. So Ida May let him go barefoot. Miss Theeny stood watching. One by one, her children had left her and gone up north. Sam and Cleve to Ohio, Josie to Syracuse, Irene to Milwaukee. Now the man Miss Theeny had tried to keep Ida May from marrying in the first place was taking her away, too. Miss Theeny had no choice but to accept it and let Ida May and the grandchildren go for good. Miss Theeny drew them close to her, as she always did, whenever anyone was leaving. She had them bow their heads. She whispered a prayer that her daughter and her daughter's family be protected on the long journey ahead in the Jim Crow car. "May the Lord be the first one in the car," she prayed, "and the last out."
That was The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. Pete Hamill is a novelist, editor, screenwriter, and one hard-boiled journalist who knows how to write a story. Hamill was born in Brooklyn, the first of 7 children of Catholic immigrants from Belfast. He had his first newspaper job at age 11, delivering the Brooklyn Daily Eagle. In the summer of 1960, Hamill went to work as a reporter for the New York Post. In 62, a prolonged newspaper strike led him to write magazine articles. By the fall of 63, he was in Europe as a correspondent for the Saturday Evening Post. He returned to New York in August 64 and worked at the New York Herald Tribune as a feature writer. In the fall of 65, he began writing a column for the New York Post. By Christmas of that year, he was in Vietnam. His newspaper career would go on for decades at The Post, New York Daily News, The Village Voice, and New York Newsday. He served briefly as the editor of The Post and later as editor-in-chief of The Daily News. He is the author of 20 books. Today we're going to speak to Pete about Tabloid City, his drama of one fateful day in the city of New York. Welcome, Pete. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thanks for having me.
Your book has it all. Tabloid City, a disgraced hedge fund manager, an Iraq war vet seeking revenge, angry extremist, and a young, ill-informed newspaper publisher who decides to turn the newspaper into a website. For inspiration, I'm guessing you don't have to look much further than the front page.
Or the interior pages, too. Or the masthead, with the names of the bosses.
I worked at the Miami Herald for 15 years, and I worry about newspapers as much as I'm sure you do.
I do, because I think if we lose them, and that's one of the underlying themes in this book, if we lose them, we're losing a sense of the local that's absolutely necessary out of a newspaper, particularly in a world of cosmic coverage of everything. And we lose some of the work that we can do that is of amazing value to people who've been knocked down and can't get up, and we can help them. People who've been injured by the society and the government can't quite function well. We can do that. We can give voice to the voiceless. We can help people function in this amazing country better. And if we lose that, it'll be an emptier country.
I've often wondered, I mean, a television station would never do the kind of enterprise story that takes months and sometimes years to finish. I mean, what is our society going to do without that, if it should come to that?
Well, it won't do anything, which is what I'm most afraid of. There's nobody going to stand up and say, "Occupy NBC." You know, it's not going to happen. But we'll be a more impoverished country than we've ever been, because the sense of being able to speak in this country, those of us reporters who've worked in dictatorships know that they become whispery little graveyards for human beings. And here we're able to yell or talk or write poetry about the things that most concern us. And if we lose that, we're a diminished country.
All right, on to your book. Why the title Tabloid City?
Well, because of the tabloid is what I've worked on all my life, the Daily News, the New York Post, other tabloids. And it's a tabloid is the shape of the paper, basically. It was invented in this country in 1919 and became the great newspaper form for people who rode subways. You couldn't unfold the Times in all of its complex glory on the A train. So it was a populist form, which didn't mean it was like the supermarket tabloid. The supermarket tabloid is all about, first of all, some of it's paid for with sources, which none of us ever did. But it gets excited over the wrong things. I worked on tabloids where great people worked, from photographers like Ouija to writers like Nora Ephron and Mary Kempton and others, you know, really top-flight people. And their standards were very high. And they helped in that way give the readers a sense of belonging to this country, because many of them were immigrants. My father became an American. He's an Irish immigrant from Belfast. He became an American once he got baseball. He didn't get baseball by reading the Federalist Papers or de Tocqueville. He got it from the sports section of the New York Daily News. And so did many, many others do the same thing in the same process. So I think if we lose that, we're losing something. For example, just in the case of the current immigration from Mexico in a place like New York, the tabloid is going to tell those young Mexicans what this city is about, but it's going to tell the larger city what the Mexicans are about. And it's a two-way process that makes us stronger in the end. It makes us say, you know, here we are. Don't try to budge us.
Your books capture such a sense of place. Lately, I've interviewed several writers who think that an author can write about a place by visiting Google Earth. What do you have to say about that?
I think you can write about a computer, but not about... I'm a strong believer in using all the senses, smell, touch. Things. Smell, for example, can't be done by television. It can't be done by a computer. You have to be aware of it, and you can convey it with language in certain ways. But to give a sense of what it is like in the place you're going to. So I tell young reporters at NYU, you want to be a reporter, get out of the house. Go to the second floor left in the tenement after the fire and find out what the damage was. Get out.
In your book, the clock seems to play such a big part. Sections are divided into hours and minutes. How did you make that decision? It certainly gives it an amazing sense of urgency.
Because I lived it. You know, newspapers are done against deadlines. You can't say, I need 3 hours more to finish this piece. You know, they take your chair away. One of the great advantages of working on a newspaper for young writers is they learn how to be accurate and how to work against time. and space to some extent, because there's only a certain amount of space. So they can get more exact and more precise against a deadline. And that sense of the clock ticking is also because I'm old. But, you know, there's a certain other kind of clock that ticks away after a certain age. But I think that sense of the clock ticking always has been with me since I became a newspaper man 50 years ago.
So what project are you working on next?
A new novel, partly set in New York, obviously, in Sicily. So I managed to get 5 weeks in Sicily earlier this year. And somehow, the first Irishman since the end of World War II to go to Sicily for 5 weeks and lose weight just by walking around.
That's a story in itself. I was going to remark, you look very slender.
Just keep walking, that's all. So that I'm about halfway through that, and I'll retreat in January somewhere and finish it.
Mm. And is there a working title for that?
Not yet, no. Mm. I usually don't come up with a title. The first title I come up with is usually horrible. So until you finish it, you can pick a phrase out of somewhere in the book and hope for the best.
Yeah. How do you think New York is doing 10 years after 9/11?
On some levels, much better. For example, I think race is much better in New York right now because September 11th was indiscriminate. Everybody died. Christians, Muslims, Jews, Mexicans, and also black people and white people. They all died. It was something that truly brought people together in a way. I always say September 12th was the most important day because people got up and went to work, which is the most important four-letter word in New York and elsewhere. Obviously, the collapse in 2007 and the economic thing is not helping matters. The last year, guns have come back. 18-year-olds are killing each other over nonsense again. And that hadn't happened for a long time. I'm apprehensive about where it might go, depending on whether this thing worsens or gets better. Because a city that's working doesn't have certain problems. A city that creates, as we learned in the 60s, if you create the person with nothing to lose, you're going to be in trouble. So I'm apprehensive about that. But I think on the level of recuperating from the horror, and I was there that day and from the first moments and was there for the anniversary, that the building is going up is itself astonishing. And the fact that Occupy Wall Street is happening a block and a half from all that, right around the corner from Brooks Brothers, by the way, in Zuccotti Square, shows that there's also some other kind of energy working that could be negative or could be positive, depending on where it goes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That was a talk with Pete Hamill. You'll find a preview of his latest book, Tabloid City, at bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of July 2nd and 3rd. Harry Belafonte is not just one of the greatest entertainers of our time. He's led one of the great American lives of our century. Now, in My Song, a memoir, written with Michael Schneerson, Belafonte shares his struggles, tragedies, and triumphs. Belafonte grew up poverty-ridden in Harlem and Jamaica. His mother was a complex woman, caring but withdrawn, eternally angry and rarely satisfied. His father was distant and physically abusive. It was not an easy life, but it instilled in young Harry the hard-nosed toughness of the city and the resilient spirit of the Caribbean. His journey led to the U.S. Navy during World War II. After the war, he moved back to Harlem, where he drifted between odd jobs. Then he saw his first stage play, and he knew he had found the life he wanted to lead. He began as an actor and always thought of himself as such, but was quickly spotted in a musical. He began a tentative nightclub career and soon had a meteoric rise to become one of the world's most popular singers. Belafonte was never content simply to be an entertainer. Even at enormous personal cost, he could not shy away from activism. He strove to break down racial barriers. He achieved an enduring popularity with both white and black audiences. Then, his activism broadened to a lifelong, passionate involvement at the heart of the civil rights movement. He had a close friendship with Martin Luther King and even became a conduit between Dr. King and the Kennedys. My song is also a portrait of Belafonte's many friendships in politics and entertainment. Paul Robeson, Eleanor Roosevelt, Sidney Poitier, Brando Mandela, Bill Clinton, even Fidel. As both an artist and an activist, Belafonte has touched countless lives. Harry Belafonte and Maren Willis narrate.
For me, it was anything goes, but I owed it to my family to keep us financially safe. Paul Robeson, the extraordinary actor, singer, and activist, whose path I tried to follow my whole adult life, had given so much money to social causes that he'd left himself vulnerable to his enemies. Chief among them, the federal government, a formidable force led by J. Edgar Hoover and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, when he was blacklisted as a communist in the late 1940s. With Senator Joseph McCarthy riding shotgun, the federal government had cowed Carnegie Hall and other American venues into not hiring him, then seized his passport so that he couldn't earn a living performing abroad. Eventually, Paul ran through his savings and slid into a deep place of sadness. I'd never forget that. Somehow I'd have to raise most of this money from others. In 2 days, maybe three. Then there was the matter of how that money would get to Mississippi. I couldn't just wire it and have a black civil rights activist go to the local Western Union office to ask for his $50,000, please. He'd be dead before he drove a mile away. So would a white college volunteer. As for banks, those fine institutions owned and operated by Mississippi's white power elite? No way. The money would have to be brought down in cash, and unless I could come up with some brighter idea, I'd have to take it down myself. My wife Julie started pulling together a New York fundraiser at our West End Avenue apartment. I flew to Chicago. Irv Kupcinet, as powerful a columnist in his city as Walter Winchell was in New York, gathered dozens of guests at his home on a day or two's notice, white guests bearing checkbooks. Why did I, as a black performer, have so much sway with Irv and his friends? Our friendship traced back to my club circuit days as a young troubadour in the early 50s, but our personal history was just one part of it. Without quite knowing how I did it, I had some power to reach a hand across the racial divide. That, I knew, had as much to do with the moment as with me. Galvanized by the shocking news of the volunteers' murders, Irv's guests thrust cash and checks at me, $35,000 worth, as if I was the personal emissary of the civil rights movement, which, in a way, in that place and on that evening, I was. After making a trip to Montreal, I had another $20,000. When I got back to New York, Julie and I took in another $15,000 from our apartment fundraiser. Time was running out. I'd hoped to raise $100,000, but $70,000 would have to do. I felt pretty good about that sum of money. I felt even better now that I had a sidekick for the trip, my pal from our days together as struggling actors in Harlem, Sidney Poitier. Sidney and I were like brothers, born within 8 days of each other. We shared the same West Indian heritage and the same burning desire to break out of grinding poverty. Incredibly, both of us had achieved our dreams as entertainers. Sidney was the top black actor in Hollywood. I had found my first successes as a singer, but had gone on to my own share of Broadway and Hollywood triumphs. We were, to put it simply, the two top black male entertainers in the world. Like brothers, we were also fiercely competitive and had our differences, both political and personal. For starters, Sidney was a lot more cautious than I was. "What kind of protection are you going to have?" he asked wearily, as I asked him to come. "I talked to Bobby about it," I said. Robert Kennedy was still serving, after his brother's assassination, as U.S. Attorney General under President Johnson. He directed me to Burke Marshall, head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Both understood the risk I was taking. In Mississippi's vicious climate, the chances of a Klansman taking a pot shot at me were actually pretty high. Knocking off that rich Negro singer from New York, who thought he knew what was best for the South? 10 points. Marshall heard me out on the phone and took down my itinerary. I conveyed all this to Sidney, maybe presuming a bit more from my conversation with Marshall than I should have. "Marshall's on it," I told him. "That means federal security every step of the way." "Every step of the way?" Sidney echoed. "Right," I said. "Besides, it'll be harder for them to knock off 2 black stars than one. Strength in numbers, man."
That was My Song by Harry Belafonte. He believed the dog was immortal. So begins Susan Orlean's sweeping story of Rin Tin Tin, the life and the legend. The tale follows the orphaned puppy to movie star and international icon. From the moment in 1918 when Corporal Lee Duncan discovers Rin Tin Tin on a World War I battlefield, he recognizes something in the pup that he needs to share with the world. Rin Tin Tin's improbable introduction to Hollywood leads to the dog's first blockbuster film and, over time, many radio programs, movies, and TV shows would follow. At its heart, Rin Tin Tin is a poignant exploration of the enduring bond between humans and animals, but it is also a richly textured history of 20th century entertainment and entrepreneurship. Almost 10 years in the making, Susan Orlean's first original book since The Orchid Thief, Rin Tin Tin is a tour de force of history, human interest, and masterful storytelling. Reader reviews are strong on this title, though many listeners barked over Orlean's narration. You decide.
Lee wrote back to the company, pleading. He said that the dog had his whole life before him and new opportunities lined up. His father and grandfather had already been celebrated around the world in silent films, talkies, radio, vaudeville, comics, and books. This new Rin Tin Tin, Lee insisted, was ready to conquer television, the coming medium, as he described it. In truth, Lee had no contracts and no connections to the television business, and doubts about its being anything more than a fad. But with the prospect of losing kennel ration hanging over him, he rushed to find a producer interested in making a television show starring Rin Tin Tin. It couldn't be just anybody, though. Lee wanted someone who he felt really understood the dog and his profound attachment to him. The winter went by with no luck, then spring, then summer. Then one September afternoon in 1953, a stuntman who knew Lee from his Hollywood days came out to visit along with a young production manager named Herbert Burt Leonard. The stuntman knew Lee was looking for a producer, and he also knew Burt wanted a project to produce. Even so, it was an unlikely match. Lee was a Westerner, an eccentric cowboy who was comfortable only with his dogs and horses. Burt was a young, loud New Yorker who gambled, smoked cigars while playing tennis, and loved attention, but had no interest in dogs. And yet their connection was lightning, and Burt decided he wanted to make a television show starring Rin Tin Tin. At the time, Burt was managing the production of a low-budget thriller called Slaves of Babylon. During his lunch break the next day, he wrote up his idea for a show he called The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, starring the dog and an orphaned boy who are adopted by a U.S. cavalry troop in Arizona in the late 1800s during the Apache Wars. As Burt recalled later, Lee went crazy for it. The story was fiction, but it captured something essential in Lee's relationship to the dog and in the dog's nature— a quality of pure attachment, of bravery, of independence that was wrapped around a core of vulnerability. The show debuted 3 years later. It climbed in the ratings faster than any show in the history of television. Almost four decades after Lee first found Rin Tin Tin, the most famous dog in the world was born again. Lee had always been convinced that his dog was immortal. Now Bert was convinced, too. As he liked to say, Rin Tin Tin just seems to go on forever. In the first years of the 21st century, Daphne Hereford hitched her 1984 Cadillac Eldorado Biarritz convertible parade car to the back of a U-Haul truck and fishtailed out of her driveway in Texas, setting off on an 11-month tour of the United States with three of her German shepherds, Gail, Joanne, and Rin Tin Tin the Eighth, whose registered name was Rin Tin Tin's Ooh-Ah, but whom she generally referred to as the old man. Gail was pregnant and needed attention, and Joanne was good company. The old man, though, was the big ticket. Daphne never went anywhere without the old man. At home, the other dogs spent most of their time in their kennels in the backyard. Only the old man had house privileges. She planned to have him taxidermied when he died, so she could always have him around. The purpose of this cross-country trip was to present the old man at German Shepherd shows and Hollywood memorabilia events around the country. It was not luxury travel. Daphne tolerated the meaner vagaries of life on the road, including, for example, the time when a friend she was staying with out west tried to kill her. She shrugs off the attempted murder, along with all the other inconveniences of the journey. I don't give up, she told me when I visited her in Texas not long ago. I just don't give up.
That was Rin Tin Tin by Susan Orleans. Dubbed the Queen of Crime by the LA Times, Edna Buchanan has covered more crime than most cops. She's won a Pulitzer Prize for news reporting. Edna Buchanan commanded Miami's police beat for 18 years. She reported on more than 5,000 violent deaths, 3,000 of them murders. She also covered kidnappings, riots, fatal fires, major plane crashes, and other disasters. 1981 was the high point of murder in Miami-Dade, with 621. In that year, Miami experienced the greatest increase in murders per capita that any city had ever recorded. It meant that Miami had the highest murder rate in the country. It also meant that a police reporter like Edna could drive to work in the morning knowing there would almost certainly be at least one murder to write about. Edna has written 18 books, including two classic true crime memoirs, The Corpse Had a Familiar Face and Never Let Them See You Cry. Much of her work features the heartbeat and hot breath of Miami, a restless, dynamic, and mercurial city. And now, Edna's new book, A Dark and Lonely Place, is a blend of fact and fiction, past and present. It's the story of John Ashley, Miami homicide sergeant and fictional descendant of the real John Ashley, a trapper and gator hunter raised in the Glades. 100 years ago, he was accused of murder and sentenced to hang. With nothing to lose, the original John Ashley escaped jail with his sweetheart, often called Queen of the Everglades. Together, they embarked on a legendary 10-year crime spree ranging from bank robbery, bootlegging, and piracy. Very Bonnie and Clyde. Welcome, Edna. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. The book fair and seeing you, it's just like Christmas morning and New Year's Eve and my birthday rolled into one, because when you work alone at home all year, it's nice to get out among your own people.
Yeah. The main character of your new book is based on the real John Ashley and his sweetheart, whose name I love, Laura Up the Grove. Yes. Gotta love that. What made you write this story, and how did you decide to blend historical fact with modern day fiction?
Well, you know, from I love history, and I love news, and you know, news is like the first draft of history. And years ago, when I first got a newspaper job. I used to love to go back to the morgue when I had time and read. You know, I went a lot to the morgue at the medical examiner's office and then the morgues at the newspapers because I'd love to dig and read about old stories. And the first thing I read was an old column about Laura, and they said that she had hanged herself in their Everglades hideout after John was killed in a shootout with the law. And it just was so interesting. It sounded so sad, so tragic, star-crossed lovers. And it was fascinating. And then when I got to the Herald, I read more about him. And still, you know, I was busy covering crime. And the city was so different than it was 100 years ago when John and Laura were there. And every once in a while, I think about it as I was out there covering crime, and we had the perfect storm of the Mariel boat lift and the McDuffie riots and the cocaine wars, the cocaine cowboys. And I think, gee, what would John and Laura think of this? And I always wanted to write about it, but I wasn't sure how. And their voices were just echoes from the past, and they were like ghostly images in my mind. And then one night in the Herald morgue, I was looking for something else, and I came upon this old photograph. And it was this handsome young man, probably still in his teens, wearing a white suit and a spiffy black tie. And his grin was so infectious, I had to smile back. And that was the first time I ever saw John Ashley's face. He became real. The legend became real. And I really, you know, he was smiling, and he looked so happy. And he came from a good family, had 9 siblings. None of them had ever had run-ins with the law. His family was extremely well-liked and hardworking. And there he was with his whole, you know, he just beamed, and his whole life was stretched out before him like a promise. And there was no way he could know how broken that promise would be, that in a few short years he'd be the most notorious man in Florida, wanted by the British, wanted by the federal authorities, wanted by all the local sheriffs, his face on wanted posters everywhere. And from my observation point, it was so poignant, from my view on the observation deck of history, looking back, seeing his picture and knowing now what he didn't know then. And one hot night, I was out there covering crime, and we were number one in homicide in the country, and under this full moon, and I just thought, what would John and Laura think of all this? And at that time, Time magazine had come out with the story Paradise Lost, that South Florida was lost to violence and crime. And of course, they were wrong, because I knew that South Florida had always been violent. It was just Miami doing what it does over and over again. Everything is cyclical. You know, like in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. In the 20s, the rum runners were being chased in fast boats up and down the Miami River by federal agents. In the 80s, drug smugglers were being chased up and down the Miami River by federal agents in fast boats. You know, nothing really changes. I was thinking about John and Laura a lot and thought, and I was just going from murder scene to murder scene to murder scene, but I was thinking, what if they were here today? What would they think of this? Or better yet, what if their fictional descendants were here in Miami? And they ran into the same chain of events, absolutely out of their control, that caused John and Laura to go into on the run and have the short lives that they lived. And how would they fare? Would they be able to change their own destiny? Or if you have that DNA, you know, that outlaw imprint in your genes, does it always have to end the same way? And I really thought about that a lot, and that was when I knew that someday I would write this book. And of course, for half my life, I wanted to write this book, and finally here it is. But I loved the research, and I loved John and Laura. I'm having like postpartum depression now because I've spent most of the last several years with John and Laura, and now I probably will not revisit them, and I miss them already. They're far more real to me than my neighbors and my friends because I, you know, was working so hard on the book for so long.
You are famous for the classic Edna Leeds. I mean, that throughout the industry and throughout across the country, that's kind of your trademark.
Yeah, I always loved to write a lead on a story that would cause, I always pictured, I never wrote for the editors, I wrote for the readers, and I could picture them in my head as I was writing. And I would think about this couple sitting at their breakfast table, and and he'd be reading the newspaper, and all of a sudden he'd spit up his coffee and say, "My God, Martha, did you read this?" And that would be my idea of a lead that worked.
I know your three cardinal rules of journalism are never trust an editor, never trust an editor, never trust an editor.
Yep, that's, you know, because they can mess up your story. They can put mistakes in it. They can take the best lines out. They can write headlines that don't match and make sense. So newspaper editors can embarrass you. They can burn your sources. They can. So that's why I had no personal life even before we became number one in homicide, because I always had to stay and look over their shoulders as they edited my story. If I had to leave, I would take a hard copy with me and call over the phone and say, "Okay, did you make any changes? What does it say?" You know, because sometimes if they have to tighten a story for some reason, you want to sort of help them figure out what to cut instead of just lopping it right in the middle or something. Yeah. So I always say to young journalism students, never trust an editor, never trust an editor, and never trust an editor, no matter how good an editor he is.
Well, your book is wonderful. I recommend it to anybody, A Dark and Lonely Place. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
A Dark and Lonely Place poses the question, can we change our destiny, or must our lives always end the same way? In Miami, Police Detective Sergeant John Ashley hunts a woman linked to a murdered millionaire. He finds she is the girl who's haunted his dreams. A century ago, on America's southern frontier, John Ashley's ancestor was wrongly accused of murder and went on the run. He and his sweetheart became the most colorful, compelling, and heartbreaking figures in Florida's violent outlaw history. Can the present-day couple break the tragic cycle? The two stories entwine in this compelling, suspenseful tale of past and present. Robertson Dean narrates.
Prologue. 1904, West Florida, near the mouth of the Calusuhatchee River. Joe Ashley came home late, grim and smelling of whiskey. He woke his wife, Lugenia, and their nine children, and told them to quickly pack up whatever they wanted to keep, because they had to leave at once and would not be back. "Was there gunplay?" his wife asked, her eyes fearful in the lamplight. Her voice trembled. "Is anybody dead?" "No, but a man was shot. He'll live. But if we don't leave now, somebody will die." She began to pack her best linens in a wooden chest. The children, still half asleep and in their nightclothes, began to gather their belongings, except for John, who was 16. "Where are we going?" he asked his father. "Get your things together now, son." John dressed quickly, carried his guitar and his banjo out onto the front porch, left them on the steps, and broke into a dead run down the dusty road. The dust, white in the moonlight, looked like silk. His father stepped out and glared after him. "It's that girl," he said bitterly, then moved to go after the boy. His wife placed her small, worn hand on his forearm and raised her eyes to his. "He just wants to say goodbye, Joe," she said softly. "You remember how it was." He nodded gruffly and caught her in his long arms. "I got to get busy," she said after a moment, and gently extricated herself. "You can't bring that sideboard," he said hoarsely as she turned away. "It's too big." It had belonged to her grandmother. "We can fit it in the wagon, Joe. Bobby and two of the girls can ride up front with us." He nodded and went to harness up the team. Laura lived a mile and a half away. John arrived breathless, his lungs bursting. The place was dark. He stood beneath her window and whistled three times like a mourning dove, a signal they sometimes used. When there was no response, he found a feed bucket, carried it to her window, stood on it, and scratched the screen three times. He heard her whisper in the dark, "John, it's me, Laura." She was suddenly there, a swift shadow in the dark. He couldn't make out her face or what she wore, but recognized her sweet scent, orange blossoms and roses. At that moment, a mockingbird burst into a soaring, full-throated, heartbreaking song in the night. John knew he would never forget the sound or that moment.
John, what are you?
The front door burst open with a crash, as though kicked by a mule. Laura's stepfather loped barefoot across the creaky porch in his long johns, brandishing his breech-loading, double-barreled shotgun.
I got you now, boy, he shouted. Freeze right there. Caught you dead to rights climbing into my little girl's bedroom.
That was A Dark and Lonely Place by Edna Buchanan.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
With unequaled insight, David Brooks, the New York Times columnist and best-selling author, explores how success happens in The Social Animal, The Hidden Sources of Love, Character, and Achievement. The story is told through the lives of one composite American couple, Harold and Erica, how they grow, push forward, are pulled back, fail, and succeed. Distilling a vast array of information, Brooks illustrates a fundamental new understanding of human nature. The unconscious mind, as it turns out, is not a dark place, but a creative one, where most of the brain's work gets done. This is the realm of emotions, intuitions, longing, genetic predispositions, personality traits, and social norms. The realm where character is formed and where our most important life decisions are made. Drawing on a wealth of current research, Brooks takes Harold and Erica from infancy to school, from the Odyssey years of young adulthood, and explores the nature of attachment, love, and commitment to the nature of effective leadership. He reveals the deeply social aspect of our minds and exposes the bias in modern culture that overemphasizes rationalism, individualism, and IQ. Arthur Morey narrates.
In his book, Strangers to Ourselves, Timothy D. Wilson of the University of Virginia writes that the human mind can take in 11 million pieces of information at any given moment. The most generous estimate is that people can be consciously aware of 40 of these. Some researchers, Wilson notes, have gone so far as to suggest that the unconscious mind does virtually all the work and that conscious will may be an illusion. The conscious mind merely confabulates stories that try to make sense of what the unconscious mind is doing of its own accord. Wilson and most of the researchers I'll be talking about in this book do not go so far. But they do believe that mental processes that are inaccessible to consciousness organize our thinking, shape our judgments, form our characters, and provide us with the skills we need in order to thrive. John Barge of Yale argues that just as Galileo removed the Earth from its privileged position at the center of the universe, so this intellectual revolution removes the conscious mind from its privileged place at the center of human behavior. This story removes it from the center of everyday life. It points to a deeper way of flourishing and a different definition of success. The Empire of Emotion. This inner realm is illuminated by science, but it is not a dry, mechanistic place. It is an emotional and an enchanted place. If the study of the conscious mind highlights the importance of reason and analysis, study of the unconscious mind highlights the importance of passions and perception. If the outer mind highlights the power of the individual, the inner mind highlights the power of relationships and the invisible bonds between people. If the outer mind hungers for status, money, and applause, the inner mind hungers for harmony and connection. Those moments when self-consciousness fades away and a person is lost in a challenge, a cause, the love of another, or the love of God. If the conscious mind is like a general atop a platform who sees the world from a distance and analyzes things linearly and linguistically, the unconscious mind is like a million little scouts. The scouts careen across the landscape, sending back a constant flow of signals and generating instant responses. They maintain no distance from the environment around them, but are immersed in it. They scurry about, interpenetrating other minds, landscapes, and ideas. These scouts coat things with emotional significance. They come across an old friend and send back a surge of affection. They descend into a dark cave and send back a surge of fear. Contact with a beautiful landscape produces a feeling of sublime elevation. Contact with a brilliant insight produces delight, while contact with unfairness produces righteous anger. Each perception has its own flavor, texture, and force, and reactions loop around the mind in a stream of sensations, impulses, judgments, and desires. These signals don't control our lives, but they shape our interpretation of the world and they guide us like a spiritual GPS as we chart our courses. If the general thinks in data and speaks in prose, the scouts crystallize with emotion, and their work is best expressed in stories, poetry, music, image, prayer, and myth. I am not a touchy-feely person, as my wife has been known to observe. There is a great, though apocryphal, tale about an experiment in which middle-aged men were hooked up to a brain-scanning device and asked to watch a horror movie. Then they were hooked up and asked to describe their feelings for their wives. The brain scans were the same, sheer terror during both activities. I know how that feels. Nonetheless, if you ignore the surges of love and fear, loyalty and revulsion that course through us every second of every day, you are ignoring the most essential realm. You are ignoring the processes that determine what we want, how we perceive the world, what drives us forward, and what holds us back.
That was The Social Animal by David Brooks.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com, magicbuz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Storms, that lovable thermonuclear vigilante, has been leaving corpses strewn across the Sunshine State for more than a decade. Join the raucous road trip as Tim Dorsey spins an entertaining oddball yarn in Electric Barracuda. The authorities, especially one tenacious state agent, have begun to notice the exponential body count and send a police task force to track down Serge. Could his luck finally have run out? Meanwhile, armed with Coleman, his perpetually baked sidekick, Serge decides to blitz the state and resurrect his internet travel advice website, which is the final word on trekking the Sunshine State. To up the ante, Serge concocts a theme variation for his cyberspace audience. And it is, you too can experience Florida through the eyes of a fugitive. Off they go, blogging along a getaway route through the state's most remote bayous, backroads, and bars. So gas up the car and join Serge on the lam as he drives straight for the deepest bowels of Florida. Oliver Wyman narrates.
People are staring. Act normal. That's how I know it's LSD. People tend to stare. They also stare at me the rest of the time, and I become humbly accustomed to the limelight. But currently they're staring from a picture in the newspaper on my lap. Some kind of country fair holding prize pig races to celebrate the local yam harvest. Now they're running around, yelling and pointing at me. They've got a bunch of torches and pitchforks. They're charging. Right off the page, right at my face. Here comes the first pitchfork in my eyes. Hold, freak out. Quick, close the newspaper. Speaking of politics, what's happening to America? All vital signs spell collapse. Unemployment, environment, national security, energy dependence, world respect, violent riots escalating into town hall meetings. Our entire population completely polarized. Half the country ready to kill the other half. And over what? For a week, it was the Dixie Chicks. Things sure have changed. FDR tried to calm us. Nothing to fear but fear itself. Now politicians encourage the jitters. Panic is the new patriotism. Today's threat level? Duck! But you don't even want to think of fear on an acid trip. Fear. 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 My body is decaying. I can feel it. I can hear it. I can smell it. And it smells like liver treats. Who would have thought? I need gum. It's in that pocket and... Wait, what's this plastic tube? An empty prescription bottle? And it has my name on it. My name is Serge. The medication on the label is some serious stuff. That's weird. But what does this Byzantine puzzle mean? The Byzantines liked snacks to go with their puzzles. It's slowly starting to come back. Of course. Lenny didn't drug me back then, and Coleman didn't this time. I'm just out of pills. My brain must have finally rid itself of their mind-blunting effects. This rampaging, all-over-the-road psychotic nightmare is just my normal thought party. Excellent. I'm looking out a window. We're moving fast. Florida nightscape whizzing by. Lights blink at an intersection. A screaming comes across the sky. It's some kind of loud horn. We're going to crash. Flames soon lapping my flesh. Another illusion. Resist. Close your eyes. Think positive thoughts. A song. It's pretty. I'm smiling and singing along in my head. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Exactly. I'm totally rededicating my life to getting along with everyone. But who wrote that marvelous tune? Elvis Costello? I hate that. Ouch. What's this hurting my wrist? A handcuff again? Sure looks real. Wait, it is real. But where did it come from? Maybe this guy sitting next to me knows. Excuse me, sir. Holy cripes! It's Agent Mahoney! Now I get it. I've finally been captured. And that horn is a train whistle. Mahoney's taking me somewhere on a choo-choo, probably the big house, just like in The Fugitive. I know. I'll use this unfortunate downtime to pretend I'm in that TV show. Serge A. Storms, a man wrongly convicted. Wink. We're coming around a bend. I see lights ahead. Another crossing gate. But what's that idiot in the pickup truck doing on the tracks? The horn's blaring nonstop. Steel grinding. Spark showering. We are going to crash. Hang on!
That was Electric Barracuda by Tim Dorsey. Readers, put the Miami International Book Fair on your calendars for next year. Every author we've covered today was at the fair. It's an amazing event that lets you get up close and personal with your favorite authors. And being in Miami in November while the rest of the country ices up is not such a bad thing. I hope you've enjoyed today's show and found some good gift ideas for family and friends. See you back here next week for more interviews from the book fair and more great titles on the Book Report.